KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump faces dissent among core supporters. Some favor striking Iran while others warn against forever wars. Where do Democrats stand? We ask one of their leading voices in Congress this hour on Morning Edition from NPR News. The Federal Reserve left interest rates alone for now. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. How is the U.S. positioned to handle the pressure of tariffs and Middle East conflict? We ask economist Diane Swonk this hour. Also, how do you celebrate Juneteenth in a time of political anxiety? We read Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. It's Thursday, June 19th. This day in 1987, the Supreme Court ruled that states could not require schools to teach about creation science if they also taught about evolution. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. As President Trump weighs whether to strike Iranian nuclear sites, members of Congress are urging caution. Lawmakers in both parties are questioning the scope of Trump's presidential authority. They want clarity on whether Trump needs congressional approval to deploy troops to help Israel. This comes as Israel and Iran continue to fire at each other. NPR's Windsor Johnston has been following developments and joins us live in the studio. Windsor?
Well, Korva, at the center of debate is whether President Trump could act without congressional approval. Now, some lawmakers say the presidential power known as the authorization for use of military force in Iran shouldn't be used as a blanket permission. That power was first used in 2001 in Afghanistan. I spoke with Alex Vatanka, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. this morning. I asked him about the legal and strategic risks of U.S. involvement.
In this case, is the issue of Iran didn't attack the United States, so how do we justify entering into a war with Iran at this point? That's a valid conversation to be had. I think the other reason why you have so much doubt in terms of where we're going with this is the magnitude potentially of the problem the U.S. will have to deal with if it enters into this war.
Without a direct attack on the U.S., the administration now is facing growing pressure to explain the case for military action. But since we haven't heard directly from President Trump today, it's unclear where things actually stand or what might happen next.
NPR's Windsor Johnston live here in the studio. Israel's defense minister is calling for the assassination of Iran's supreme leader. Speaking to reporters today, he compared Ayatollah Ali Khamenei to Hitler and reiterated it was time for him to go. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports.
Speaking to reporters in Holon, the worst-hit suburb of Tel Aviv Thursday, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said that killing Iran's supreme leader is a goal of the war. The Israeli military was directed and knows that in order to achieve all the objectives of the war, this man certainly cannot continue to exist, he said. Earlier this week, Katz said, quote, "We will strike the Iranian dictator everywhere." That came after the Israeli military struck an Iranian state TV studio. About the supreme leader, President Trump posted this week on his social media platform, Truth Social, quote, "We know exactly where he is," but added, quote, "We are not going to take him out, kill, at least for now." Hadil Al-Shalji, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Ukrainian officials have finished searching an apartment building in Kyiv. It was hit by a projectile from Russia this week, killing 23 people. This is NPR. A federal judge has ruled there is enough evidence to bring a federal hate crime against the suspect accused of firebombing peaceful protesters in Boulder, Colorado. 15 people were injured as they marched to support hostages held in Gaza. The judge says it will be up to a federal jury to determine the suspect's motivations. The Buss family says it is selling majority control of the NBA's Los Angeles Lakers. It's one of the most expensive sports transactions ever. As Steve Futterman reports, the sale involves a group led by the owner of Major League Baseball's L.A. Dodgers.
Under the deal, Mark Walter and his holding group will acquire majority ownership of the Lakers from the family of Jerry Buss, who bought the team in 1979. The specifics have not been released, but the sale sets valuation of the Lakers at least $10 billion, more than any other professional sports franchise. The Lakers have been one of the NBA's most successful teams, winning 17 championships and featuring some of basketball's legendary players.
Kobe Bryant!
From Kobe Bryant and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to more recently,
James, it's gone!
LeBron James. When Jerry Buss bought the Lakers in 1979, he paid just $67 million. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Today is Juneteenth. The federal holiday celebrates the day in 1865 when Union troops reached Galveston, Texas. When they arrived, they told all remaining enslaved people held there that they were free. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Coming up, we hear about how the Trump administration's immigration crackdown is hurting those who supported America's wars. But first, President Trump remains undecided on whether to join Israel's war against Iran. Here's some of what the president said to reporters yesterday about striking an Iranian facility at Fordo.
We're the only ones that have the capability to do it, but that doesn't mean I'm going to do it at all.
In the space of a few minutes, the president said, quote, I've had it with Iran, but also said that in war, quote, a lot of bad things can happen.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us to talk about it. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Leila.
So you were part of the scrum of reporters pressing President Trump yesterday for details of his plans. What's he signaling?
You know, the president continues to leave the door open for U.S. strikes. In the Oval Office, he told us he has some ideas about what to do, but that he also likes to make final decisions at the last minute because things change, especially with war. And he had this to say on the lawn.
I may do it. I may not do it. I mean, nobody knows what I'm going to do. I can tell you this, that Iran's got a lot of trouble, and they want to negotiate. And I said, why didn't you negotiate with me before all this death?
Yesterday, he met again with his national security team inside the Situation Room, and they are clearly continuing to discuss these next steps.
So we hear him there saying, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't. I mean, is this just a negotiating tactic to pressure Iran?
I mean, that is always a high potential with Trump. I mean, remember, his message is often peace through strength, and he's definitely giving off some mixed signals. Mm-hmm. I mean, I asked him several times about whether he'd send U.S. officials to meet with Iranians, which he said he might. Trump said Iranian officials have actually reached out to him to negotiate, including suggesting a visit to the White House. Trump said he was open to that idea and appreciated the offer, but he also said it was probably too late.
Okay, how is Iran responding?
I mean, strongly. I mean, the foreign minister released a statement last night saying that Iran is solely acting in self-defense and that they are not seeking to develop a nuclear weapon. And Iran's diplomatic mission to the United Nations dismissed Trump's claims that Tehran seeks negotiations with the White House, even calling Trump cowardly. The mission said they would not negotiate under duress.
Franco, you told us yesterday about how the prospect of U.S. involvement has really split Trump's most ardent supporters. Anything new there?
Yeah, it really has. And Trump has really bristled over the comments from former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who opposes U.S. intervention. Trump actually said yesterday that Carlson called him and apologized for some of the things he said. But Carlson has not backed down, nor have others, such as Trump's former aide, Steve Bannon, who told reporters at an event yesterday that MAGA world is very concerned about another forever war. Trump had this to say about those kind of concerns.
I don't want to fight either. I'm not looking to fight. But if it's a choice between fighting and them having a nuclear weapon, you have to do what you have to do.
Can we talk more, though, about his evolution? Because this is a dramatic shift from just a week ago when he was invested in a diplomatic resolution with Iran.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he's had an evolution in his thinking. And he acknowledged that yesterday, explaining how it shifted after the first night of strikes, how he has been disappointed in the slow pace of negotiations. You know, that evolution has been particularly stark over the last few days. You know, first denying involvement in the strikes to later taking some credit for it. And now Trump is saying that the U.S. may be the only ones to finish the job.
That's NPR's Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you.
How's Congress viewing all of this? Yesterday, we heard House Republican Mike Lawler, who flatly said yes when asked if the U.S. should strike. Today, we have the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith of Washington State. Mr. Smith, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate the chance.
Are you persuaded that Iran has a secret nuclear weapons program, which is the Israeli allegation that they made as they began the war?
I think that's probably likely. I mean, as we've moved through this whole process, gosh, Iran has always been doing more. We've discovered that Iran has been doing more than they've said publicly, and it's not actually a secret that they've been massively increasing their enrichment capacity. As I think one expert put it, you know, there's no country in the world that doesn't have a nuclear program that has as much enriched uranium as Iran has. So clearly they're trying to get right up to the edge.
But I will just mention, experts on this have done a distinction between gathering the material, which they clearly are doing in a massive way, as you say, and actually starting a program to build a bomb. You think it is likely they are doing the latter?
Well, yeah, I mean, people draw that distinction, but I think it's more accurate to say, yeah, I think Iran's position is we're going to go right up to the edge, but we haven't made a decision yet. But the concern is they get right up to the edge, and then they're, in some cases, you know, mere weeks, if not days, away from making that decision and then getting a bomb. Look, Iran took an enormous chance by enriching all this uranium. The IAEA came out and said they're not in compliance with what they said. So there's reason to have concern that Iran could, in fact, be days or even weeks from making that decision and then having a bomb. I think that's fairly widely agreed upon.
The Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war, of course. In recent history, Congress has generally avoided that responsibility. But in this case, is it necessary for Congress to speak in some way?
I believe so, yes. I mean, I don't think that we should get directly involved in attacking Iran. And if the decision were to be made to do that, I think Congress should, under the Constitution, our approval should be required.
And that is true not just for a full-scale war, but for an airstrike? Because we had somebody on our air yesterday who said a mere airstrike is something different than a full-scale war.
Yeah, I mean, technically different. And let me be honest here. I mean, I feel strongly that if we're going to attack Iran in that way, There's no argument that this is inherent right of self-defense. There's no existing AUMF that would justify this. I feel strongly that legally the president should come to Congress, but the history of this is clear. Presidents do what they want to do on a whole series of instances. I mean, we had during Kosovo, had a vote in Congress that actually went down to approve the President Clinton's actions. And President Clinton went ahead and did it anyway. There was no congressional approval for our involvement in the Libyan campaign during President Obama's administration. So as a practical matter, I think President Trump would assert the right to do this without Congress. can probably get away with it, but that doesn't change the fact that I think the law and the Constitution are clear that he should not be able to do that.
I want to ask how far this might go. We think of it as one U.S. plane flying overhead, dropping one really big bomb, and we're done. But then this morning we worked through the problem of striking Fordo, this facility under a mountain, and we talked with Michael Knights, an analyst, and the logic of it causes Michael Knights to put boots on the ground. Let's listen.
There's many ways that you can possibly destroy those facilities and certainly do them a lot of damage without drilling down into them with a big bomb. But if you want to be sure, and if you want to actually remove the highly enriched uranium, then maybe a commando operation is an option.
Commando operation. Suddenly we're sending in troops in his scenario anyway. If we're going to commit, do we have to commit to a full-scale war if it comes to that?
Aside from the legality and the constitutionality of this, there are two big problems with the U.S. getting involved. Number one is that. You know, what's it going to take to completely destroy Iran's nuclear weapons program? I can tell you I've been briefed on this for years, and there's always been considerable concern that destroying it is going to be vastly more difficult than people realize. How much damage can you do to this particular site? And also, does Iran have other sites? We don't think they do, but then again, we didn't think they had this one until we discovered that they did. So number one problem is how do you actually make sure that you destroy it? Number two problem is if we attack Iran, we have facilities. We have bases in Qatar, in Bahrain, in Iraq, in Syria that Iran has said they will target. If we get involved in this war, Iran will start hitting U.S. troops, and then it becomes unpredictable, which is why I do not think that we should do this.
Democratic Congressman Adam Smith of Washington State, bottom line, not to act. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As part of its aggressive immigration policy, the Trump administration has been making it harder for asylum seekers to stay in the U.S., and that includes at least one immigrant seeking safety here after helping the U.S. military in his home country. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
The scene of ICE agents arresting immigrants at courthouses has become common in the past few months, but this one played out a bit differently last week in San Diego. Bystanders filmed as Syed Nasser was approached by two masked ICE agents after a routine immigration hearing. They don't show a warrant, and they don't even seem to be sure they have the right person.
What's your name?
As they handcuff him, he starts to tell the onlookers that he's a former interpreter for the U.S. Army.
I work for the U.S. military back in my home country, Afghanistan.
Syed Nasser asked to withhold his family name because he fears for their safety in Afghanistan. And that's the whole point, says his lawyer, Brian McGoldrick.
He spent 3 years working with the U.S. military at great risk to himself, and they've already killed part of his family.
Syed Nasser fled Afghanistan after the Taliban showed up at a family wedding and killed one of his brothers. He made a journey from Afghanistan to Brazil and then, sometimes on foot, traveled north to the U.S. border, where he was admitted legally last year. But McGoldrick says ICE agents took none of that under consideration.
It was all about filling their quota of 3,000 a day. They didn't care that, you know, he was really our ally. I don't think anybody took the time to even go through that.
ICE confirmed to NPR that Syed Nasser is in custody but didn't answer other questions. Sarah Verardo is with the advocacy group Save Our Allies. Her husband Mike was severely wounded in Afghanistan. In fact, President Trump hosted the Verardos at the White House just this April to honor that. But Sarah Verardo says seeing Afghans like Syed Nasser arrested is another wound.
And so much of the moral injury that we see among veterans now has really resurfaced with these issues of how we've abandoned our Afghan allies. And the Trump administration has an opportunity, while they do pursue strong immigration reform, to also say that as a nation, we stand with those who stood with us.
So far, there's no sign the Trump administration will shield Afghan allies from the immigration crackdown. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we revisit painter, sculptor, and filmmaker Titus Kaphar's directorial debut, a film loosely based on his life, titled Exhibiting Forgiveness. It's about a celebrated painter whose world unravels when his estranged father, a recovering addict, suddenly reappears in his life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today is Juneteenth. This day in 1865, Army troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, and told some of the last enslaved Americans they were free. The Army was enforcing President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation from a couple of years earlier.
We'll hear the proclamation in a moment, but first we're going to hear from organizers of Juneteenth celebrations who tell us how they're feeling this year, a year in which private and government funding has been pulled from diversity initiatives.
Cautious. Cautious would probably be a good word.
Kenneth Adams and other planners in Bend, Oregon, felt a festival in a park could be vulnerable.
Given the nationwide climate, we are heavily about making sure that people are safe.
So they canceled. Another group revived the event, but smaller and indoors.
In West Virginia, the governor eliminated a paid day off for state employees like Ray Whiting.
I am disappointed in the governor's decision.
Whiting helped to plan an annual Juneteenth parade and festival for the past 4 years in the capital, Charleston.
So we moved the event to Friday. That way people won't miss and all parties can celebrate.
Norman Harris has been planning Denver's Juneteenth Music Festival since 2012. This year, it was a single day instead of two.
We had a number of corporate partners who have been supporting us over the years who either pulled back their support or just were not there this year.
But even with less business support, Harris says the festival was beautiful.
It's a cultural treasure chest where people are immersed in Black culture and celebrating Black excellence.
Organizers of Nashville's Juneteenth 615 Festival, which is named after the Nashville area code, they say it will be bigger than ever. Willie Sims, known as Big Fella, says it's too important to skip.
There's been communities celebrating this since 1866. Like, when you actually go and say we're going to cancel it, I think you're literally going to bring more of a light to it.
Some voices of organizers of Juneteenth celebrations, and now our NPR colleagues read the Emancipation Proclamation.
By the President of the United States of America, a proclamation. Whereas on the 22nd day of September in the year of our Lord 1862, a proclamation was issued by the President of the United States containing, among other things, the following, to wit,
that on the first day of January in the year of our Lord 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free.
And the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons, and will do no act or acts to repress such persons or any of them in any efforts they may make for their actual freedom.
That the executive will, on the first day of January aforesaid, by proclamation, designate the states and parts of states, if any, in which the people thereof respectively shall then be in rebellion against the United States.
And the fact that any state or the people thereof shall on that day be in good faith represented in the Congress of the United States by members chosen thereto at elections, wherein a majority of the qualified voters of such state shall have participated, shall, in the absence of strong countervailing testimony, be deemed conclusive evidence that such state and the people thereof are not then in rebellion against the United States.
Now, therefore, I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, by virtue of the power in me vested as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, in time of actual armed rebellion against the authority and government of the United States, and as a fit and necessary war measure for suppressing said rebellion,
do on this first day of January, in the year of our Lord 1863, and in accordance with my purpose so to do publicly proclaim for the full period of 100 days, from the day first above mentioned, order and designate as the states and parts of states wherein the people thereof respectively are this day in rebellion against the United States, the following, to wit:
Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, except the parishes of St. Bernard, Plaquemines, Jefferson, St. John, St. Charles, St. James Ascension, Assumption, Terrebonne, Lafourche, St. Mary, St. Martin, and Orleans, including the city of New Orleans,
Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, except the 48 counties designated as West Virginia, and also the counties of Berkeley, Accomack, Northampton, Elizabeth City, York, Princess Anne, and Norfolk, including the cities of Norfolk and Portsmouth, in which accepted parts are for the present left precisely as if this proclamation were not issued.
And by virtue of the power and for the purpose aforesaid, I do order and declare that all persons held as slaves within said designated states and parts of states are, and henceforward, shall be free.
And that the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authorities thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of said persons.
And I hereby enjoin upon the people so declared to be free to abstain from all violence, unless in necessary self-defense. And I recommend to them that in all cases when allowed, they labor faithfully for reasonable wages.
And I further declare and make known that such persons of suitable condition will be received into the armed service of the United States to garrison forts, positions, stations, and other places, and to man vessels of all sorts in said service.
And upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God.
In witness whereof, I have hereunto set my hand and caused the seal of the United States to be affixed, done at the city of Washington, this first day of January, in the year of our Lord 1863, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 87th, by the President, Abraham Lincoln.
A reading of the Emancipation Proclamation on Juneteenth. This is NPR News.
What happened after enslaved people were granted their freedom and not much else? Today, a former plantation in Alabama houses a new exhibit on that history.
We invite you to step into the shoes of these people who are living on the precipice of a change in history.
Hear that story and the latest on Iran on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Fighting between Israel and Iran is escalating 1 week after Israel began attacking Tehran's military and nuclear sites. Iranian missile attacks today have injured at least 240 people in Israel. Dozens were hurt in Tel Aviv when an Iranian missile hit a high-rise apartment building. In southern Israel, a main hospital was hit, causing extensive damage. Dozens more were injured there. President Trump says he still hasn't decided whether the U.S. will join the Israeli operation aimed at eliminating Iran's nuclear threat. NPR's Franco Ordonez says Tehran rejects Trump's call for unconditional surrender and blames Israel for starting the war.
The foreign minister released a statement last night saying that Iran is solely acting in self-defense and that they are not seeking to develop a nuclear weapon. And Iran's diplomatic mission to the United Nations dismissed Trump's claims that Tehran seeks negotiations with the White House, even calling Trump cowardly. The mission said they would not negotiate under duress.
The resort city of Acapulco is among the areas of southern Mexico being lashed by Hurricane Eric. It made landfall this morning as a major Category 3 storm with top sustained winds of 125 miles per hour. Flooding and potential mudslides are expected. This is NPR News from Washington. Last night's test of the SpaceX Starship rocket in South Texas ended in an explosion in what the company calls a major anomaly at its starbase. Nobody was injured. The explosion sent a huge fireball into the night sky. This is Juneteenth, a federal holiday that commemorates the day the last enslaved people in Confederate states, specifically in Galveston, Texas, learned of their freedom. As Cassidy Arena with Nebraska Public Media reports, the holiday has new meaning for people in Omaha, where the city recently elected its first black mayor.
In May, Democrat John Ewing Jr. won the mayoral election of Nebraska's biggest city, ousting the 12-year Republican incumbent. His term began 10 days ago. Ewing says his election has reinvigorated Omaha's Juneteenth celebration, and he believes Omaha can set an example for the nation.
We can be like the rest of the country and have all of the fighting and all of the anger and have that be counterproductive, or we can look at how we can be great together.
The Omaha Juneteenth Parade did lose sponsors this year due to diversity, equity, and inclusion rollbacks required by the Trump administration, but organizers say it's their biggest parade yet for the tradition that started in the 1980s. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena in Omaha, Nebraska.
There's no trading today on Wall Street. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump keeps pressuring Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell to lower interest rates. The Fed keeps making independent decisions. And yesterday, the central bank said it is holding its benchmark interest rate steady for the fourth time in a row. Here's Powell yesterday.
Despite elevated uncertainty, the economy is in a solid position. The unemployment rate remains low, and the labor market is at or near maximum employment. Inflation has come down a great deal, but has been running somewhat above our 2% longer-run objective.
Jerome Powell is one of the few people whose job matters so much that it is news when he chooses to do nothing. So we've called back Diane Swonk. She's chief economist at the accounting firm KPMG US and can help us see why this matters. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think Powell is trying to tell us?
Well, basically, he's saying there's no news here. Move along. And we're not going to cut rates anytime soon because of the threat of inflation. And that's really important, because if this had been a different world, the Fed would already be cutting rates back to what it considers neutral, not the 2% cut we heard recommended yesterday, but actually what they think is neutral, which is close to 3%. They're at 4.5% right now. But they're willing to hold back a little bit because they're uncertain about how long and how big the bump in inflation will be due to tariffs, something that Powell made the point of over and over again yesterday.
Now, this is very interesting. Essentially, Powell is saying, I'd like to cut interest rates, but the president might still go through with huge tariffs. We don't know what's going to happen. He's saying, I wonder if he's also saying, I'd like to cut interest rates, but you might be diving into a war soon.
There's a lot going on. And it's not just that the tariffs, you know, there might be more tariffs. It's the tariffs we've seen already are much more than anybody anticipated. And they've come through in a staggered way and caused supply chain disruptions that are really reminiscent of the pandemic. And we know what happened then. Now, we don't have the cushion of COVID-era stimulus to support the kind of inflation we saw then, but some kind of bump in prices. One point Powell made over and over again is that somebody's got to pay this tax. And whether it be through production cuts, whether it be squeezing profit margins at retailers and layoffs there, or an increase in prices, or all of the above, which is what the Fed is essentially forecasting, stagflation, which is a toxic mix of rising unemployment and rising inflation, not like the 1970s, but enough that the Fed has to hold off until they see the full effects dissipate. And they want to see that inflation is going to be coming back down again. Unfortunately, what they're forecasting is that that's not likely until unemployment moves up. Not enough to trigger a recession, but we've already seen in this economy, it doesn't take an actual recession to feel like one.
So what does it mean for me if I'm a consumer, if I'm a home buyer, if I'm a home seller, if I'm just trying to deal with a credit card bill? What does it mean for me that interest rates are not coming down in the way the Fed might have liked?
Well, it means that it's going to stay more expensive to get out of that credit. And that's the, you know, end of the line. That is where we're at. And the reason for that is that he's trying to constrain demand to meet a supply constrained economy now. And the Fed is still smarting, and so are consumers, from the blistering inflation we saw in the wake of the pandemic. And that inflation itself gives us a bit of a muscle memory about inflation that you don't want with yet another supply shock. And this isn't just a one-time shock. It's an on-again-off-again shock that's caused many more problems that could be more inflationary. And the Fed can't move until they know we've passed that point.
Very briefly, is it good for me if I'm trying to save some money? I can get a little higher interest rate on it.
You can get a little higher interest rate. There's no question about that.
Diane Swonk is chief economist at KPMG US. Thanks for the analysis. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says seed oils like soybean, corn, and sunflower oils are poisoning Americans. Most of the medical community rejects that. But the messaging from the White House and its allies is causing real headaches for farmers who grow the oilseed crops. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
The oil from pressing corn, canola, soy, and other plant seeds used to be known simply as vegetable oil. Now it's widely called seed oil, and RFK Jr. says the stuff triggers chronic inflammation. His Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA movement, recently released a documentary slamming seed oil, along with fluoride and farm chemicals. Here's Catherine Shanahan, who calls herself Dr. Kate, on the video.
The source of the most toxins is seed oils. They are worse than glyphosate, herbicides, pesticides combined. When you've been eating seed oils, your cells can't get energy out of it efficiently. And that's what causes heart attacks and strokes.
The American Heart Association, the Mayo Clinic, and many other health advocates disagree. They point to decades of studies that show that seed oils reduce bad cholesterol and help stave off heart attacks and strokes. However, seed oils are used in deep-fried foods and high-calorie processed snacks, typically full of salt and sugar. That stuff is unhealthy, and seed oils may suffer a kind of guilt by association.
I have made a big drastic switch in my personal life. I've decided to just not use them.
Philip Stegner is general manager at Billy's Grocery, an upscale bakery and cafe in Kansas City.
We've had a lot of people come in here and be like, are you guys totally seed oil free? And I'm like, no, but we have a very big emphasis on using healthy fats.
Even burger chain Steak and Shake is switching to butter and sauces and now sells bacon double cheeseburgers with fries that are cooked in beef fat or tallow, not seed oil. The disputed claims about soy, corn, and sunflower oil have reached all the way to the sunflower farm that Cameron Pierce operates in central Kansas.
I mean, my own kids, my son just walked through here, and I'll use him as an example. He goes, 3 months ago, he said, seed oils are bad for you. And I'm like, well, scientifically, they're not. He's getting it from social media.
Pierce says those TikTok posts are a real threat to the business. Farmer Tim Michelson feels the same. He grows canola, another seed oil crop in North Dakota, and says losing money over innuendo is galling to farmers who work all day, every day in the realm of empirical reality.
Everything we do revolves around science. So the MAHA movement, it's kind of been frustrating for me to watch because those decisions are based off of fear, speculation, and information that is not backed by science.
Michelson says he believes the movement has so far cut canola sales by maybe 5%. He's surprised that the anti-seed oil trend has taken hold, worries where it'll lead. Farm lobbyists say they're engaged and hope to protect farmers who grow seed oil crops. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
This is NPR News. Juneteenth celebrates the end of slavery in the U.S. The Charleston Museum has a collection of slave tags used to identify enslaved people with a job. That's next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. A black bear cub was spotted in Michigan 2 years ago with a barrel lid stuck on its neck. The bear evaded capture until this month. It was seen on a trail camera, and wildlife experts set up a trap. The bear was sedated within minutes. They cut off the lid, and the bear turned out to be perfectly healthy. He woke up and scampered away, and hopefully won't stick his head in any more barrels, although it was a nice necklace while it lasted. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Picture this. In Central California, there are miles of produce, miles of farmland, produce that needs to be harvested to make it to grocery stores across the country. The question is whether there will be enough people to pick the strawberries or the grapes and other fresh fruit. Farmers worry the fear of immigration raids could lead to labor shortages. Joshua Yeager from KVPR reports.
Murray Family Farms is an oasis along State Highway 58 in the hills just outside Bakersfield. Travelers like Lorianne Carrion stop for gas, but also tend to leave with heaping basketfuls of fresh produce.
I love blueberries and blackberries the best.
The market is housed in a giant red barn that evokes Laura Ingalls Wilder. Just outside, lush berry bushes and stone fruit orchards stretch for miles.
Central California is probably the best place to buy any kind of fruits or vegetables because mostly it's harvested out here.
Kern County is the country's top agricultural producer. Farms here grossed more than $8 billion in sales in 2023. But growers are sounding alarm bells across this region, often referred to as the nation's fruit basket.
We're concerned about the disruption of food production.
Brian Little is with the California Farm Bureau. He says fear caused by President Trump's immigration policies is sparking labor shortages in the state's agriculture industry.
I'm aware of some situations where people have been unable to conduct normal harvesting operations because there aren't enough people and their employees don't want to go out, don't want to go to work, but they can avoid it.
If crops are left to rot in fields or packing houses during the upcoming harvest, Little says grocery prices could surge.
When a clamshell full of strawberries costs $8 or $9, how do you think consumers are going to react to that? I'm guessing not well.
Last week, President Trump suggested the agriculture industry might be spared from his immigration crackdown. But any thought of exemption was short-lived. Days later, the Department of Homeland Security confirmed there had been no change in policy. The mixed messages came as no surprise to many Central Valley farm workers, including Alejandra, who asked that only her first name be used because she hasn't obtained legal status.
There's a lot of whiplash. One day the president says he's going to attack, and then the next day he changes his mind, while the migration agents are doing something else entirely.
Earlier this year, CalMatters found that dozens of farm workers without criminal records were arrested in a Kern County Border Patrol operation. And recent videos showing federal agents on farms renewed Alejandra's concern.
I have bills to pay and a kid to feed, so I'm going to work. But I'm going to work with a lot of fear.
Some 75% of all farm workers in the state are here without legal status, according to research from UC Merced. That heightens the stakes, not just for Alejandra, but also shoppers.
Without us, people won't be able to get those basic fruits and vegetables on their table.
Even some Republicans are beginning to push back. Congressman David Valadao signed a letter addressed to the head of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, urging the agency to focus on immigrants with known criminal records. Yet this week, in a statement to NPR, DHS doubled down, saying there will, quote, be no safe spaces for industries that try to undermine ICE's efforts. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Yeager in Bakersfield, California.
This is NPR News. You have made it to Thursday, and this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Democrats are rethinking their approach to winning the votes of young men. Most male voters under the age of 30 supported Donald Trump for president. That was a rightward shift from previous years. A new survey of more than 1,000 young men has some insights. Aaron Smith is with the Young Men's Research Initiative, which commissioned the survey. He spoke with our colleague Michelle Martin about the findings and the concerns of young male voters.
Their concerns are not that dissimilar to many Americans. Number one is inflation. Number two is cost of housing. They're worried about their future. 47% of them say the economy is getting worse. That's about the same as it was during the last election. So they still feel this intense dissatisfaction with the status quo, this sense of not having a clear path to the middle class.
How did these young men talk about what they saw as their larger role in society?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question about what does it mean to be a man in today's society. In many ways, their values are not that dissimilar to our fathers or grandfathers in the sense of they value protecting their family. They want to be able to provide for their family. They value honesty. That said, we have an online media environment that caters to some of their worst impulses. You know, this idea if you're listening to an Andrew Tate and you feel like you're invisible as a young man, well, here's someone who might have answers for you. That is pervasive online.
That was one of the other fascinating things that you asked about how young men are spending their time. And it would seem, I'm not trying to be judgmental here, but it just seems like a lot of the ways they're spending their time is very much at odds with what they say are their goals.
It's a group that spends a ton of time online. At the same time, they will say people spend too much time on their phone and they spend too much time online. There's a conflict there.
So let's get into a little bit more of the politics of this. Are young men interested in politics?
Young men have low trust across institutions, but particularly in politics. They say that both political parties are corrupt. So elected officials have a lot of work to do to regain that trust. But I think that we need to take young men at their word when they say their top issues are the cost of living, cost of housing, and address those. I think we make a mistake when we try to write a story about a whole generation based on how they vote every 2 years or every 4 years. It can be inauthentic and it can come across as pandering, I think, to try to say, oh, we have to get the messaging just right for this group. When what they're asking for is they're saying, I'm dissatisfied with the status quo. I have these real concerns, particularly on the economy. And what are we going to do to address those?
Why is housing so important to young men? Can you just, I have a theory about this. It's because it speaks to your ability to form a household. You can't fulfill your traditional role in the family by saying, I'm going to provide a house or home for my family.
I think it comes back to that idea of protect and provide. You know, I protect myself and I protect my family and my community. And part of that is by having a home. And we've taken that opportunity away from so many young people.
So if you're a Democrat, what should you take from this? And if you're a Republican, what should you take from this?
I think Democrats and Republicans should draw the same message, as just they cannot take young men voters for granted at all.
They are
not
attached.
Yeah, I think they've taken this group for granted for a long time. And I think it's only been a recent phenomenon that where I've on all these conversations about young men voters. And so this idea that this group has been invisible, I think, rings true for a lot of young men. And so elected officials have a lot of work to do to regain that trust and to put forth policies that are actually going to make a difference in this group's life.
That's Aaron Smith. He's the founder of the Young Men's Research Initiative, which recently conducted a survey of more than 1,000 young men in the United States in partnership with YouGov. Aaron Smith, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you very much.
Surveys show people are drinking less these days, choosing moderation or non-alcoholic alternatives. But songs about drinking never go out of style. Here's NPR's Chloe Veltman.
The roughly 250-year-old song, Three Nights Drunk, about the tricks an adulterous wife plays on her inebriated husband, appears twice on Drinking in Here. It's a new compilation of boozy tunes culled from the archive of the pioneering American musicologists Alan and John Lomax. There's the cut by J.E. Maynor's Mountaineers from 1959, recorded in North Carolina.
Well, the first night when I come home, the drunk I couldn't see.
And the version by Jim Henry, recorded in Mississippi in 1937.
The first night when I came home, just as drunk as I could be.
Record producer David Katz Nelson curated the album.
It's a total tradition that these drinking songs are not only passed around in an evening, but they're passed around over years.
Pass around a bottle and we'll all take a drink. Pass around a bottle and we'll all take a drink.
Katz Nelson says tracks on the album like this one perfectly capture what drinking songs are all about, the spirit of sharing.
Drinking songs are about camaraderie, which is something we really need right now.
Around 100 recordings of the 8,000 in the Lomax archive are drinking songs. Anna Lomax Wood helps to run the archive. She says both her father Alan and grandfather John liked to tipple.
My grandfather used to take a little flask of what he called the water of life, hidden in his jacket, and he'd go off and excuse himself and have a little swig.
But her forebears didn't drink while working, even when the singers themselves were soused.
I spend my money and I can't get ashore. Roll, roll, roll and go.
Like the day in 1962 when Alan Lomax recorded a group of workers performing the song Roll, Roll, Roll and Go on the Caribbean island of Grenada.
I don't think he had time to be in the culture of drinking songs. I think he loved to see it.
There's some sort of cultural universal about getting a little tipsy, wanting to sing about it.
This is Sayer Pietrakowski. He's a Cicerone. That's like a sommelier, but for beer. He also writes a Substack about drinking and music. Pietrakowski says there's a direct line between the artists featured on the Lomax album and those singing songs about drinking today, like Shaboozy. He says the best drinking songs, like this one, are always a bit self-aware. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Cheers. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
All alone, you just change.